I have to have a pretty strong reason to not support something. And so I'm still looking at that. What I know of it, I'm comfortable with.
Governor Walker and three of his top election opponents all come out in support of the Donlin mine. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 6th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, confusion and frustration for immigrants who join the military to get citizenship.
So they're going to have shortages of healthcare professionals. They're definitely going to have shortages of language speakers.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
A Copper Center man died after he was shot by at least one Alaska State Trooper early this morning. The Department of Public Safety did not immediately release how many troopers were involved or how many responded to the home in the Richardson Highway community of 300. Troopers received a report shortly after 2:30 a.m. that 38-year-old Eric Hash was assaulting a 72-year-old family member and placing other family members in fear. Troopers received a second report that Hash had left and returned. Family members barricaded themselves inside and reported Hash was yelling at them and damaging property. At least one officer responded to the home. Troopers say Hash was shot at about 3:15 a.m. and died at a hospital. The state medical examiner will conduct an autopsy. Autopsy results are pending for a man missing in Anchorage since January and found in mudflats near a local park. Anchorage police say the body of 27-year-old Robert Dushkin III was spotted last weekend by a man riding his bike near Carr Godstein Park. Police released Dushkin's identity Thursday. Police say Dushkin was from the village of Sand Point, near the Aleutian Islands, and was living in Anchorage at the time of his disappearance. He had last been seen January 7th in South Anchorage. Police say an examination is underway to determine the cause of Dushkin's death, but investigators initially do not believe it involved foul play. A new legal opinion from the solicitor of the U.S. Department of the Interior throws doubt on whether Alaska tribes can gain Indian Country jurisdiction by putting land into trust with the federal government. The land in trust issue has a long, complicated history. Basically, if the Interior Department agrees to acquire a tribe's land in trust, the tribe can exercise sovereignty over that territory. Trust land is similar to an Indian reservation, and it's exempt from some laws, typically local zoning and taxation. For decades, the Interior Department has gone back and forth over whether Alaska tribes can put land into trust or whether that's precluded by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The Obama administration did not see ANCSA as a barrier, and just before President Obama left office, his Interior Secretary accepted 1 acre in the center of Craig into trust for the Craig Tribal Association. Other Alaska tribes have also applied to put land into trust. But the new acting solicitor, the top lawyer for the Interior Department, issued an opinion in late June that says the Obama administration's legal reasoning was incomplete, and he's ordered a new period of consultation and review. He says that'll take at least a year. The top 4 candidates in Alaska's gubernatorial race are all in favor of the proposed Donlin gold mine in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger has the details.
Governor Bill Walker made headlines this past weekend after he asked that the Army Corps of Engineers suspend the environmental impact statement for the controversial Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay. But Walker, who is running for re-election as an independent, and 3 other top gubernatorial candidates have pledged support for the Donlin Mine, which would be one of the biggest gold mines in the world. Walker says Donlin so far appears to be following the rules of regulatory process.
I have to have a pretty strong reason to not support something. And so I'm still looking at that. What I know of it, I'm comfortable with.
His competitors tout other benefits of Donlin Mine. Former Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell is running as a Republican, and he praises Donlin's promise to bring more jobs to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
There's mines around the state that employ a lot of people, and it's one of the most important things we can do for regional development.
The project also proposes a 315-mile-long gas pipeline from Cook Inlet to fuel the mine's operations and power demands. Former State Senator Mike Dunleavy, who is running as a Republican and will face Treadwell in the GOP primary in August, says that the pipeline is a huge energy opportunity for the YK Delta and the state.
A lot of the spinoff industries will benefit both in the YK area and South Central Alaska. So I think it's a huge opportunity for the entire state.
Former U.S. Senator Mark Begich, who is seeking the Democratic nomination in the primary, has voiced support for Donlin for years and believes that the project that is based on Native Corporation land can coexist with the subsistence lifestyle in Western Alaska.
They've understood the value of fishing. They understand how important it is to subsistence lifestyle.
The Donlin mine would increase barge traffic on the Kuskokwim River, which is the food source for many residents in the YK Delta. And it will require large treatment facilities for mercury and cyanide. Donlin has already received a water permit from the state to discharge wastewater into Crooked Creek, which drains into the Kuskokwim River. People living in the YK Delta are also worried about what happens after the mine stops producing. The site would have to be monitored in perpetuity, or forever, once it ceases operations. Governor Walker says he doesn't see the state relaxing monitoring enforcement, even with the budget crunch the last couple of years. He's confident that the state can adequately regulate the Donlin mine.
We certainly have laws in place. I believe if we need to strengthen those laws, then let's strengthen those laws.
Treadwell and Dunleavy will battle each other in the August primary for the Republican nomination. On the Democratic side, Begich remains unopposed, and the winners will face Governor Walker in November. For the Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schellenberger in Bethel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating a successful whale harvest in Nuiqsut.
There really isn't anything held back as far as community, not just community service, but that feeling of being welcome.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Immigrants who join the military under a program granting a pathway to citizenship are being kicked out of the service and face uncertain futures. The Military Accessions Vital to the National Interest, or MAVNI for short, was designed to recruit non-citizens into the armed forces due to a shortage of healthcare jobs and fluency in languages deemed strategically important. Alaska attorney and former Senate candidate Margaret Stock is a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve and helped develop the MAVNI program. For months, she's been contacted by immigrants who joined the armed services in the last few years who are now being told they're disqualified.
Nobody will tell them why they failed. Nobody will tell them who made the decision to fail them. They're not being offered any evidence. They're not being given due process. And they're just simply getting a text message, an email, a phone call saying that the military has decided after a couple of years of background checking that they don't want to take a chance on you and you're being kicked out.
Attention on the changes to MAVNI roared back into headlines after an Associated Press article came out on Independence Day. And since then, Stock has been fielding calls from national TV networks and newspapers. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes spoke with her today about what's happening to immigrants in the military.
The program's been mismanaged by the Department of Defense in the last couple of years. And the mismanagement has gotten to the point where they have completely destroyed the program. And they're also now attempting to get rid of many of the recruits who came into the military through the program.
What does that look like at the level of clients contacting you and clients that you've worked with? I mean, what's happening to them?
It's chaotic. It's alarming. People are feeling a great sense of unease. Their lives are being ruined in many cases. A lot of people are now applying for asylum.
I wonder if you have any particular client that you've worked with who you think exemplifies kind of the process of what's happening.
There's so many of them, I don't really know where to start. But a typical one is, say, somebody who went to college in America. They speak English fluently. They have a degree, maybe even a master's degree. They joined the military at least 2 years ago. All the people that we're talking about signed enlistment contracts in the United States military more than 2 years ago. And they've been patiently going through the background vetting that's required. The Pentagon has kept piling on more and more background vetting. So when they signed their enlistment contracts originally, they went through lots of vetting before they signed the contract. They went through a lot of vetting after they signed the contract. And every few months, the Pentagon seems to add more vetting. And they patiently go through it, and no matter what they do, they can't seem to get through the vetting. The Pentagon doesn't have the resources to do all the vetting that they ordered, so they've started to just get rid of people.
What happens to people after that?
Well, in some cases, they file lawsuits. One of them has just filed a lawsuit in Washington, D.C. to try to reverse the decision kicking him out. He says he doesn't know any reason why he can't serve in the military. He was all excited to be serving. Other people are taking it more philosophically. Some people have actually left the United States. They've moved to Canada or Australia. They've decided the U.S. is no longer friendly to immigrants and they don't want to be a part of us anymore. Some of them are going to the news media and telling their story in hopes that they will get the attention of Secretary of Defense James Mattis and he will reverse the decision.
What have you heard from the Pentagon or defenders of the policy changes?
Well, interestingly, they don't seem to be coming up with a good reason for anything. They just say national security, national security, national security. National security, of course, covers a multitude of sins. They have not been open about the reasons why. They won't tell people what their problem is, what the derogatory information is. They're not even sharing it with Homeland Security. So it's been a very mysterious and odd process. My impression is from having looked at some of the files that they don't actually have good reasons for discharging people, that it seems to be arbitrary, capricious, and irrational. I'm hearing odd things like, well, they're not really in the military. Well, they signed contracts that the Pentagon believes are binding. So it's rather odd for the Pentagon to suddenly say these contracts aren't binding on anybody anymore. Some people are saying, well, we don't need them anymore. We should only have American citizens in the military. And I guess that's an argument, but we don't have enough qualified American citizens who are signing up right now. And the Pentagon is not making the recruiting goals that were set.
Do you anticipate this having an effect on the military's overall readiness and preparedness?
Yes, this is going to hurt readiness deeply. It means they're not going to get enough U.S. licensed healthcare professionals into the military. The Pentagon reaction to that is, well, we can go to Congress and get more money for bonuses and maybe we'll get enough doctors. But they had that in the past and they still couldn't get enough native-born American doctors to sign up for the military. So they're going to have shortages of healthcare professionals. They're definitely going to have shortages of language speakers. Their response to that is, well, we can hire contractors.
When somebody signs up for the military and takes an oath to the U.S. government and to the country and then is separated involuntarily and goes back to another country or is repatriated, I mean, what is the effect of that?
Well, it really depends on the country, of course. Some countries will put you in jail, torture you, consider you a traitor. I would not want to be a discharged Mavni soldier going back to a country like Iran or Pakistan even or China. Those countries are not, they don't view their nationals favorably when people from those countries come to the U.S. and then join the United States military. They're hostile to our military, and they think you're a traitor if you have joined the military.
Colonel Stock, thank you so much.
Yep.
Messages left with the Department of Defense seeking comment were not returned as of our broadcast deadline. Every summer, communities across the North Slope gather for Nalukituk feasts hosted by successful whaling crews. This year, one was held on the summer solstice in Nuiqsut, a village of about 400 on the North Slope. Nuiqsut's whaling crews harvested 4 bowhead whales last fall. The Iqbalik crew took one of them. Elizabeth Harbaugh of Alaska's Energy Desk was lucky enough to be at the Iqbalik crew's Nalukituk and has this story.
Whaling Captain Herbert Iqbalik Sr. sits in the driver's seat of a white pickup, parked at the center of a sandy baseball field. Around him, the celebration is beginning. Today is his whaling crew's Nalukituk, and Nalukituk is special.
Special because it was created thousands of years ago and passed on to the younger generation, to the next generation.
Iqbalik upholds this tradition.
It's about the whale. The whale gives up to you, to the people that worked really hard.
Next to Apolluk's truck, folding tables are weighed down with big steaming pots and colorfully frosted cakes. The baseball field's bleachers are filling with family members and neighbors, kids and elders, bundled up in puffy coats, furs, and blankets. The crew starts serving homemade goose and caribou soup, bread and crackers, and hot drinks.
Coffee?
Later, the focal point, the whale, comes out in huge plastic tubs. It's prepared several ways, like mikiyak, fermented meat, uruk, cooked meat, and muktuk, frozen skin and blubber, carved into hand-sized chunks and eaten raw.
Thank you.
The crew carefully distributes the whale based on the number of people per household, and everyone's coolers start to fill up. Some is eaten on the spot, and the rest is stored for take-home in plastic containers or Ziploc bags.
On here,
thank you.
Give me the
Vera Ipaluk is at the center of the action. She's the whaling captain's wife. In between making sure everything is going smoothly, she sneaks in a few hugs.
Well, here's my oldest grandson. Hi, sonny boy. I like your sweater.
Thank you.
Get out of here. See you later. Love you.
Her family is here from near and far, almost all her kids and grandkids, she says. But it's not just about the relatives. Vera wants everyone to feel welcome.
I make sure that my crew have a bigger smile on their face to keep people happy.
That translates into many moments of joy, like the candy. There's so much candy. Every half an hour or so, Hershey's chocolates, Laffy Taffy, and Sour Patch Kids are tossed over the bleachers, and the kids pounce. There's even more candy during the event Nalukatuk is known for, the blanket toss. A circular sealskin blanket is suspended 10 feet above the ground. Men and women grab hold of the edges and start pulling in unison, and one brave soul holding a bag of candy jumps on top.
1, 2, 3. Almost, man.
There's an art to it. Getting the timing down isn't as easy as it looks. They try again. 3, 4. When it's done right, the person on the blanket is catapulted upwards and candy goes flying. It makes your average trampoline look pretty tame. Once everyone has their turn on the blanket, the day ends at Nuiqsut City Hall, where the village gathers for drumming, singing, and dancing. The sealskin from the blanket toss becomes a dance floor at the center of the room. A line of men in folding chairs leads the singing, keeping time with shallow hand drums. James Tollick is among them.
I've been drumming all my life, since infancy. Since probably before I could walk.
Tollick says Nalukatuk songs have been passed down for generations, heard not just in Nuiqsut, but across the Arctic, in Canada, even parts of Russia. Some of the music has even more universal themes, he says, like invitational songs to get everyone up dancing. And most everyone does. Elders and children, Nuiqsut residents, and visitors from far away all take their turn on the sealskin blanket. Tollick says Nalukatuk is for everyone.
There really isn't anything held back as far as community, not just community service, but that feeling of being welcome.
The dancing goes on until the early hours of the morning. On the wall behind the drummers, there's a line of framed photographs of elders who have passed on. Nuiqsut's past leaders, whaling captains, and whaling captains' wives, looking on as today's generation carries forward the Nalukatuk tradition. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Nuiqsut.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Meals on Wheels. Food trucks are pretty common in Anchorage and some of the other larger Alaska communities, but what about everywhere else? As KMXT's Daisha Eaton reports, one food truck in Kodiak is creating quite a stir, serving up El Salvador cuisine.
Inside the bright blue food truck parked in the driveway of their simple one-story home, the Martinez family spends most Friday nights chopping and prepping enormous amounts of cabbage, carrots, and cilantro.
We are from El Salvador. We sell pupusas, tamales, but at the same time, we sell Mexican food. We got tacos, burritos, quesadillas. We had two kinds of tamales, Salvadorian and Mexican tamales.
That's Moises Martinez. He explains that Mexican tamales are wrapped in a corn leaf, while Salvadoran ones are packaged in a banana leaf. After conditions in his home country of El Salvador became dangerous, Moises moved with his wife and children to California. He heard there was money to be made working at a fish processing plant on Kodiak Island, so he traveled here. He only planned to work one season, but he liked it in Kodiak, so in the early 90s he brought his family, and they've been here ever since. Martinez says he thinks there are roughly 100 Salvadorans here. Many, like Moises, came to Kodiak fleeing war, found good jobs, became involved in the community, and stayed. Martinez has a full-time job as a dock foreman at one of the fish processors. But for years, his family has been selling pupusas along with Mexican cuisine from small stands off and on around town. In his spare time, he says he recently converted and customized the family's food truck himself.
If you look from outside, it looks like a regular small bus. I call a bus. But actually, inside is completely different. Took up all the seat and changed all the floor, put a new walls on ceiling, and ready to cook.
Martinez says it took him about a year to transform the minibus into a commercial kitchen. It's a family business.
I like how busy it is.
That's 21-year-old Jency Martinez, Moises' daughter. Before she went off for training to become a dental hygienist in Washington State, she worked 4 summers at the family's food business to save up money for school.
I mean, I know how to cook everything in there. It's, like, taught me a lot. Sometimes your parents being your bosses, you know, it's kind of different. But it's good. It just, I don't know, it keeps me busy.
And Jency is busy. She has 3 jobs.
Monday through Friday, I work down over there at the dental office. Saturday mornings, I work at the coffee shop. And then Saturday afternoons, I help out here.
Jency's mother, Maria Portillo, is the cook. She prepares family recipes, and Jency takes orders. But before Maria prepares the food, she has to do a lot of chopping.
Cabbage, carrot, and the cilantro, and the pepper, and the one, I have a lot of vegetables. Yeah.
She starts on Friday evening after she closes her in-home daycare and preps the food until late into the evening.
This is salad for the pupusas. And we need to make everything today.
She gets up around 6 a.m. to finish and make tamales. She's ready to open the food truck by 11 a.m. on Saturday. Over the years, all her kids have helped out. That they are proud to share the foods from their homeland makes her happy, says Maria.
All the kids, they make tamales, make pupusa. I have my old son. He's the ingeniero. He lives in Seattle. He make a pupusa. My other son, he is studying in the, Arizona. He make a pupusa and tamale, and they, when they have a party, and they say, this is the food for my mama country. Yeah.
The truck is nestled between a coffee drive-thru and a large construction project along Kodiak's main drag. As soon as they open the window, people start lining up, brought in by the aroma of lime, cilantro, and frying meat. Inside the truck, Jency and Maria do a well-choreographed dance as chicken and steak sizzle on the grill. Jency takes orders and makes change while Maria puts food into go boxes.
It's the quintessential food truck.
That's Erin Briggs, who's lived in Kodiak just a couple of years. She says she was excited to see Maria's appear.
Everybody loves tacos. Been out and about all day, and it was a great reason to not make dinner.
Moises Martinez says that earnings from the business in its various forms have helped the family achieve several financial goals, but it isn't just about how many tacos they sell. He says they brought their business back with the new food truck because they love sharing their food and a little bit of their culture with the community.
We're happy to be cooking for the community of Kodiak, and we're happy again that they're enjoying. Actually, we had a few comments this last week, and it's my first time I tried that this food, and it's the best food in Kodiak. We're happy to hear that, and thanks for everybody to support us.
Maria's Place, the food truck, is open Saturdays through the summer. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Louis Pagel in Kotzebue. Pagel is a chiropractor who also serves on the local city council.
You know, I was practicing in Minnesota. My wife was a public defender down there, and I was a chiropractor. And we just kind of got sick of living in Minnesota. We're from Wisconsin originally, and there's a football battle there that we played into pretty good. And we weren't really attached to anything, so we decided to, you know, strike out on a new adventure and saw a posting for a chiropractic clinic here in Kotzebue. And I said, yeah, if you want to move to Alaska, I'll try it out. We came up here thinking we might stick around for a couple years and then move on and try something new, but we fell in love with it and decided to stay. Been here for just about 11 years now. I'm a big outdoors person, lots of fishing, lots of hunting, riding snow machines all winter and spring long, and this just seems to be the best place in the world to do it. This last weekend, my hunting partner and I were out riding around looking for muskox. He had a tag, and it was a windy, stormy day, but we found a herd and made a good stock. And now I've got a muskox down in the shop and in the garage that we're working on cutting up, and I had muskox burger for lunch today. And we've moved to a few places when we were younger, my wife and I, and most of the community seemed to be really clicky that we moved to, but when we got here, it seemed a little different, kind of just one big click. Everybody here seems to help each other out a lot more than I experienced in the lower 48. I think a lot of people try to avoid local politics, so when someone puts their name in the hat, oftentimes they'll get the privilege, so to speak, of being able to serve the public. And I've always been a public servant my whole life. It's just, I serve people. That's what I love to do.
Louis Pagel lives in Kotzebue. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Daisha Eaton, Ann Hillman, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Nooksit, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.